So it's May 27th, 2020, and the hardcover of my book, The Hilarious World of Depression, has been out in the world for only a few weeks. And I get a Google alert that my name has popped up somewhere. It's a link to a newspaper in Cleveland about a graduation speech, virtual speech, COVID just getting started, by Kevin Love. He plays for the Cleveland Cavaliers of the NBA. Quote, during and after his speech, Love referenced some of his favorite books, The Meditations by Marcus Aurelius, The Hilarious World of Depression by John Moe, 21 Lessons for the 21st Century by Yuval Noah Harari, and Range by David Epstein. All of those books have had a profound impact on Love in some way, allowing him to better understand himself and helping him learn how to cope with obstacles while living a better, more fulfilling life. Unquote. And I was all, whoa, I'm really brilliant and important. No, that's not what I thought. I thought, this is great. And also, what's Kevin Love doing reading my book? What do we have in common? Kevin's an NBA All-Star, fifth overall draft pick. He has won an NBA championship, and I couldn't dunk a basketball if I was on a ladder that leaned on the rim. Kevin Love is much younger than me. He's very wealthy and famous. His dad, Stan Love, played in the NBA. Stan's cousin is Brian Wilson, and Kevin's uncle is Mike Love, both of the Beach Boys. My only uncle was a Norwegian cheesemaker. By the way, it's Depression Mode. I'm John Moe. I'm glad you're here. But then again, Kevin has dealt with depression, and Kevin has dealt with anxiety, and he's from the Pacific Northwest. And he's a human being with a complicated mind, just like me, and I'm guessing just like you, dear listener. Sure, he makes a lot of money. God, he makes so much money. But depression and anxiety don't look at your paycheck before deciding to infect you. They just do. Kevin Love, welcome to Depression Mode.
I appreciate you having me.
You've dealt with anxiety. You've dealt with depression. This isn't the first place you've talked about that.
Right. Oof. Yeah.
When did that start for you in your life?
Very young. I mean, I can remember, you know, and it's funny, like I had a pretty good childhood from what I can remember, but I was always very anxious. And I don't know if that was to be like a high achiever, if it was to take care of my family financially, because we had problems of that, with that growing up, or if it was, you know, having to be, you know, the golden middle child, if you will, and everything that comes along, with that. But I, you know, sometimes it's not, you know, self-induced. It's, you know, hereditary. It's something that has been in my family, especially on the darker side. And when we're talking about depression as well, I would just have, you know, moments where I just, you know, did not and could not get out of bed. It was very, very dark. And I didn't, I'm saying that to say that I didn't understand it at all. Right. Like, and I would want to compartmentalize it. I did not know what it meant to be vulnerable. I thought I'd be looked at because I was, you know, a damn good sports player from early on. I was very precocious, very ahead of my time in that way, and tall, and, you know, people, you know, younger kids looked up to me, especially when I got to high school. A lot was expected of me, so I'm like, I can't expose this in any way.
Other people need look at me to as, be this way.
Yeah. Yeah, other people are like that. And also, like, I would compare grief. I think I sometimes still do that. Is, you know, it's who am I and who am I to feel this way? There's people who have it way worse than I do in this world. But, like, you know, as you know, like, you know, comparing grief, but also withholding compassion, like, nobody benefits from that. Not you, not anybody else. And that was something that I learned the hard way.
You mentioned grief. What, did you lose someone?
Well, I lost my grandma. That was my fifth year in the league. It's 2013. I'm trying to backtrack here. I'm heading into year 15. So it all kind of blends into each other at this point.
Okay. Yeah.
But it was 2013. It was right before, I remember it was December 4th, actually. And she had passed, and I wasn't able to see her before she passed. So I never, and she was supposed to actually come out and see us for Thanksgiving, not too long, you know, before. And that would have been her first trip to Minnesota. So it was around the holiday, and that was when I always got to see my grandmother. Even when I was in the NBA, it was always for, you know, her May 25th birthday, or around the 4th of July, or around my September 7th birthday. And then those moments of nostalgia growing up and, you know, seeing her for every holiday, and her making, you know, her special Carol's pie that she would make. And no, it just, she felt so, and still feels so much like home. So reflecting back on that was, you know, that grief was tough for me until I had that very, you know, public moment and panic attack back in November of 2017. I had started going to therapy, and I was like, wow, I never grieved. I never allowed myself to go through that process and kind of reflect back on my grandmother's life, the moments we shared, but also how much she meant to myself and for my family.
Your dad played in the NBA, and your middle name is Wesley after the Hall of Famer Wes Unseld.
That's right.
Was there pressure from as far back as you can remember that you're next, that you need to make it to the NBA?
Oh, yeah.
Is that coming from you or from your family?
Both. And for even people outside of that, and it's even worse now, I feel like in, you know, AAU sports or in travel basketball at an earlier age, everybody feels like they deserve something. Everybody has their hand out. Everybody wants something.
Right. So these kids, you're the ticket.
You're the ticket out. I mean, honestly, you're the ticket out. And like, it has me ask and beg the question, like, what would you have done because anything can go wrong. It'd be a knee injury. Anything along the way can go wrong and set you off of that, you know, linear path that can be the difference in, you know, not making it to professional sports. And also, even when you make it, there's no guarantee that you'll get to a second contract. There's no guarantee that, you know, it all works out. So you're basically putting it all on the line and putting it all on the shoulders of one person to be, you know, they only stand as tall as you, but it's you're the backbone of the family at that point. You come from being a 16, 17, 18 year old to where you're at 19 years old coming into the NBA. And then, you know, you're the breadwinner and you are not financially literate and you have all these people asking you for all these things, and expectation is so high as well.
And you've been famous since you were like 13, probably by that point. Like people, the AAU games, and people knew who you were before you could drive, I'm sure. I think most of us can't imagine the kind of pressure that goes along with that. And it makes me wonder, like, does that seem normal because it's what you grew up with? Or did it just seem like, what the hell is happening?
It definitely is something that you never, I guess, truly get used to. But I think because I was exposed to it at such an early age that it just became, you know, normal, or something that my life was then accustomed to. But yeah, I think having all those eyes on me and absorbing and feeling a little bit of agoraphobia at the same time, like, okay, public embarrassment, I'm doing something wrong, or this person has their phone out, I gotta, you know, at a restaurant, like, watch what I'm doing. Even though I wasn't doing anything wrong, I felt the anxieties of not being able to just be a kid, you know, because I think there was so much. I even, you know, just went back to Portland, Oregon, and my AAU coach from Portland in those days was telling my wife, who knew nothing about the player that I was during that time, only the things that I told her, saying, yeah, we were good, blah, blah, blah. But he said, you know, everybody treated Kevin like he was a 25-year-old when he was 14, 15 years old, and he never got to live a normal life. So I think it was part of being a big fish in a small pond, too, growing up right outside of Portland, Oregon. And I was the number one player in the country. There was a lot that came with that. There was a good amount of love, but maybe even more, you know, hate, saying nobody makes it from here. And, you know, where he's from, it's soft and, you know, but.
Who does he think he is?
Exactly. So I started asking myself,
I'm like, who
do I think I am, right? Like, that was, I think that's something that imposter syndrome definitely goes through your head. Like, I'm not deserving, even though I'm willing to put in the work. Like, I'm not working hard enough. Who am I to think I'm going to make it here? But I don't know. I always had that. I think, you know, it's a little bit of a gift and a curse having that, you know, anxiety drive you into some special things. I think on the other side of that, you know, it definitely can be a gift in some ways if you can harness it.
You talk about this anxiety and this depression and the I think I'll just stay in bed thing from a very early age. Did people notice it? Like, did your siblings notice it? Did anybody say, hey, there's something going on with Kevin?
I think my yeah, family just has a, like a disposition to melancholy. I think within my dad's side, I mean, you even go back to like, you know, Brian Wilson, I know that they said he, you know, was in bed for, you know, years and years, but that's not actually the case. It was, you know, weeks and maybe weeks at a time, but, you know, still he was, you know, he went through a lot of his, you know, mental illness and mental health problems. And, you know, obviously everybody that has paid attention to that knows the story about, you know, Eugene Landy and what, you know, happened there as well, and how he was medicated.
Doctor, right?
Yeah. His pseudo doctor.
Pseudo doctor.
Doctor is a relative term. Yeah. But no, and then I think on my dad's side, if you look back, you know, I'm sure that you can connect the dots there. But I think that, yeah, I definitely caught some of that, and it was inherent in me for sure. And I think that I did a really good job of hiding it. And I think, you know, sometimes you just have to fake it until you make it and just, you know, figure it out as you go. But man, I do wish that I could speak to my younger self and just say, hey, listen, like it's okay to feel this way. Like, fuck the stigma. There's my curse. It's coming.
There you go.
You know, fuck the stigma. Just like live life outwardly and openly. I wish it wouldn't have had to come to such a, you know, serious and public life moment and mental health moment for me in a moment of crisis to actually seek help and to get therapy and try to, you know, right some things in my life or add up some things in my life that weren't going in a positive direction.
Are you technically by lineage considered a Beach Boy yourself?
not if you were talking about musical inclination, absolutely not.
Is it like a British royal family thing?
basically. Okay. That was, you know, kind of the one thing, one of the things I was alluding to early on was like that idea of fame. I mean, I looked at my uncle just as like, oh, that's just Uncle Mike. It's my dad's brother. But in seeing that up close, especially like in the early and mid 90s when I was like so susceptible to that stuff and so young, I was born in 88, that it was pretty powerful to see that and to see what that meant for him, like being in the public eye, because I mean, the Beach Boys still hold weight. I mean, that's a very prominent name in rock and roll history. And, you know, it wasn't until I went to UCLA where there, you know, people weren't like, oh, you're this big recruit that we just got. They're like, oh, you're Mike Love's nephew. Like all the parents were like, what are the Beach Boys coming? Is he coming to games?
I was
like,
my God,
he's a very big deal.
Coming up, Kevin Love has had a lot of very high profile achievements, star player on every level, all-star pick, NBA champion, but you cannot achieve your way out of depression. You know what I like? I like when things are easy. Man, easy things are just the best. Because obviously, there are plenty of parts of life already that can be very, very difficult. So bring on the easy. My favorite easy things, I have to admit, are when something seems like it would be difficult, but turns out to be easy. Oh, I love that. Case in point, building your own website and web presence with Squarespace. I did this years ago and found it to be delightfully simple. I can build a site, make changes, redesign everything if I want, all very simple. Squarespace is the all-in-one website platform for entrepreneurs to stand out and succeed online. Squarespace makes it easy to create a beautiful website, engage with your audience, and sell anything from products to content to time, all in one place, all on your terms. You don't need to be a web guru. You become the guru. Start a completely personalized website with the new guided design system, Squarespace Blueprint. You can choose from professionally curated layout and styling options to build a unique online presence from the ground up, tailored to your brand or business and optimized for every device. Make checkout seamless for your customers with simple but powerful payment tools. They accept credit cards, PayPal, and Apple Pay, and in eligible countries, offer customers the option to buy now and pay later with Afterpay and ClearPay. Upload video content, organize your video library, and showcase your content on beautiful video pages. You can even sell access to your video library by adding a paywall to your content. So why not get started now? Go to squarespace.com for a free trial, and when you're ready to launch, go to squarespace.com/depresh to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. squarespace.com/depresh.
Hello, dreamers. This is Evelyn Denton, CEO of the only world-class, fully immersive theme resort, Steeplechase. You know, I've been seeing more and more reports on the blogs that our beloved park simply isn't safe anymore.
Murder them?
I'm gonna wreck it.
They say they got mugged by brigands in the fantasy kingdom of ephemera, or hijacked by space pirates in Infinitum.
I mean, I could have a knife.
My papa said that I needed to do a crime.
Friends, I'm here to reassure you that it's all part of the show. These criminals were really just overzealous staff trying to make things a little more magical for our guests. We're just as safe as we've always been. This isn't a county fair, dreamers. This is Steeplechase.
The Adventure Zone, every Thursday at MaximumFun.org.
Back with Kevin Love of the NBA's Cleveland Cavaliers. You and I have talked a little bit in the past about this idea that often comes with a depressive tendency of, if I could just get to this next level, then I'm gonna solve it. So you go on from high school on to UCLA. You were fifth overall pick in the draft when you got drafted. Yeah, and you know, lots of achievements at a very early age. You were what, 19 or so when you got drafted, I would think.
19. 20? Yep. Played my first game at 20, but yeah, drafted at 19.
Jeez. And so, like, did you think along all those steps through college, through the draft, through, you know, the pros, that you were going to get to a point where this was all going to go away because you'll have succeeded enough?
Yes. But it's funny, you know, it's funny you bring that up. I spoke about that. Again, I think I just mentioned that about my AU coach. Was I was just in Portland. I was looking up on stage, and you're talking about the idea of achieving yourself out of depression. That's what I loved about your book, was like, he gets it. Like, this is exactly what I've been trying to, like, I it's like word vomit, but I can't articulate it in a way that, you know, like somebody's understanding. I'm like, why is it just not ever good enough? Or why do I regret so much?
Right.
But for me, even last week it happened, and I was talking about it earlier today. Last week, I'm looking up on stage, and it's the, you know, global director of Nike basketball, Lynn Merritt, who's like a mentor to me. We call him the general. And then it's LeBron, it's Gary Payton, it's Scottie Pippen, it's Bo Jackson, it's Ken Griffey Jr. and Charles Barkley. And they're all up there. And they're the way that they're speaking and the, and, you know, kind of the things that they're being super vulnerable about and peeling back. I spoke to a near and dear friend of mine that works at Nike and was sitting right next to me. I'm like, man, my heart's actually broken, like, for myself right now because of the exact same thing that we're talking about here. I'm like, man, I look back and, you know, I wished away a couple moments of my time in the NBA. You know, there were times where I was so dark and so depressed where I almost like was considering retiring. I had this conversation with Giannis actually this summer, and there was moments where I was so worked up. I didn't want to outwardly face 22,000 fans, like, you know, night after night. It was like exhausting having to play this character. And I was expected, because, you know, I was making this money and I was successful, that I was just going to be happy. And that I thought to myself, you know what? I have to show up, because if I just get that next accolade, if I just hit that next milestone, if I just get that next contract, if I just do this and this and this and this. But then it just kind of, you know, you said it in the book too. You're like, you're just left with the brain you still have, right? Like, you're still, at the end of the day, yeah, you can achieve that, but, you know, it's fast fleeting.
Because the brain is set up to try to reach for the next thing.
Right. And if there's that dangling carrot, right? Like, you just keep reaching, you keep, and I think, again, it's a gift and a curse in that way, but the idea of like reflection to me on the other side of that, like looking back and giving myself a pat on the back, wasn't something that I would even consider. Cause then I'm like, I'm complacent. I'm never going to get there. I'm never going to be happy. This moving target of happiness is forever going to be miles and miles and miles away. It's like a never ending, you know, triathlon that I'm putting myself through.
one time I was at the Target Center. This was your rookie year. I was doing a story for some radio thing, and I left the Target Center, and I walked by where the players park their cars, and you were getting out of your car. And I kind of looked at you, and I was like, oh my God, that's Kevin Love. And I smiled, and you smiled back, and I saw such fear in your eyes. It's always stayed with me. So right. It's the one other time that we've met, Kevin.
Oh, wow. Okay. So we were in a Target. That was back when they had the old, like, you just pull in there and it was
pulling right in front of the building. Exactly.
Probably like the worst parking setup in the league at the time. But now Target Center is beautiful now.
Yeah. I mean, maybe you had just eaten a bad muffin or something. Maybe that's all it was. But yeah, I just remember thinking,
at the time I was a few pounds over what I am now.
I just remember thinking, I hope that guy's okay.
Yeah.
And you were in Minnesota as a rookie. How many years did you play in Minnesota?
6 years, yeah.
And that's when, I mean, we're going to talk about the panic attacks, you know, that kind of led to your being very public about mental health. But it seems like the darkest times you went through were your years in Minnesota.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely I think it was 2012, 2013. Yeah, absolutely. Actually, I know, because it was the year that we come off the summer of the Olympics, and heading into that year, I only played 18 games that year. So like my safe space and basketball was taken away from me. But definitely, you know, being 19 years old and not having any tools, and not, you know, I had to feel like, I felt like hiding this was the best route to go because I didn't know anything else. It was definitely a fear-induced, highly stressful time for me that I think, again, I have gray hair now, but I think it definitely aged me in a way that as an athlete, you don't want to be, you know, aged. Here I am going into my 15th season, but still, I think it was a weight on my shoulders that I guess at some capacity didn't need to be there. It didn't need to be that heavy, you know?
Yeah. How bad did it get?
Oh, it got bad. It got, you know, I think suicidal ideation definitely creeps in. And you start thinking to yourself, I mean, the question, you know, I asked during that time is like, what's the only way to make it stop, you know, completely stop? There's ways to mute it. There's ways to, you know, feel like you've had a couple of glasses of wine, if you will. But I think that's self-medicating, self-sabotaging. And, you know, I don't think that's healthy for anybody. But I think you get such blinders on that you just don't give a shit. You know, you're just like, I just want this to stop in whatever way that I can do it. Or maybe the easiest way, everybody wants a quick fix, right? That I'll just do this.
You talked about playing being your safe space.
Mm-hmm.
When you're on the court, and I've heard especially basketball players talk about this, you know, when you kind of get into the zone, is that where the anxiety and the depression goes away and you're just doing this beautiful dance of basketball?
That's it. It is a beautiful dance. And I think that's always where I've just gone. And I think it's like really fun to be, you know, really good at something.
Mm-hmm.
And on top of that, it just being in my blood, as you mentioned, my father playing and then being named after a famous basketball player, while that, you know, definitely adds some complexity to the whole situation, that it also makes it super fun to chase that. And it just so happened that I grew up loving the game. I loved being around a basketball court, you know, the way that, you know, you can walk into a gym and feel the energy, you can, you know, the smell of the leather on the basketball, the squeaking of the shoes, you know, a sweaty jersey, like, you know, taking a little elbow, but being like, hey, it hurt so good. There's so many things that add to it on top of the competition. I think it's the fans, being a fan first for me before I even really started playing organized basketball, to, you know, the bright lights, the stage. And I think, yeah, there still is that like nervous energy to it. But that was always like, you know, that was always the safe space for me that kept me coming back for more. It was almost like a drug in that way.
So did you start to feel better mentally when you got over some of those injuries that limited you to 18 games a year? Did that pull you out of it, or was it going to Cleveland that pulled you out of it?
I think
or
it
did
was,
you get pulled out of it at all?
Yeah, no, I think yes and no. I was kind of laughing there, kind of smirking, because I never really got pulled out of it until, you know, I would say, yeah, at the end of the 17-18 season. And trust me, it got a lot worse before it got better. But I think coming out of that 18-game season in 2012-13 season, that I had a lot to prove. And I've always loved that idea of being the chaser. You know, being at the top and being chased is one thing, but to actually, you know, be the hunter, that to me is definitely the most fun. And
to like prove yourself, to prove that you belong? Okay.
Yeah, prove that I belong. I feel like I've always had that chip on my shoulder and always, you know, had to do that. And I think, again, that has something to do with like that, you know, nervous energy that I have to be this and I have to make it and I have to achieve. But I think on the other side of that, it's, you know, I'm still doing it on the basketball court, which I lose sight of quite often.
So that's interesting. I mean, we talked about this idea, if I can just get to this next thing, then I'll be happy. And then, you know, you get there. But then you also talk about the pursuit of the striving and the trying to prove yourself as being a good thing. So is it a matter of just trying to establish this recognition that you do have worth all along in order for that to be a positive result?
You know what? If you have the answer, please tell me.
I've done 75 episodes of this show trying to find it. I'll let you know.
No doubt. Yeah. I mean, maybe, you know, maybe 76. But I honestly, you know, I think the beauty is, I mean, we were joking about it before we came on. It's like those little hiccups in your interviews. And like, I just made a best man speech at my best friend from growing up, his wedding. And I'm like telling everybody that's speaking, I'm like, listen, just because like it's me up there speaking, like I'm going to mess up. I'm going to, you know, something's going to happen. But like that's in that like journey of you speaking, it humanizes you and like puts you, you know, in a beautiful space where like those little intrinsical things along the way, along the journey that were hiccups or a bump in the road, good or bad. I mean, I think that's where like the beauty and the satisfaction lies, because actually like when you get to the end, you're like with those things, especially like, okay, that wasn't so bad. But even when you, you know, achieve something, it's so much better when you are doing it for something just greater than just yourself. Cause for you, it's kind of like, I'm not saying it's narcissistic, but it's only affecting really, you know, one person. And like for your vanity or your sanity, like it's kind of definitely unfair to yourself, but it was all those, you're like, damn it, I'm so glad that I worked so hard. But then you're like, okay, what's next? I can have like one. I always say this, I'm like, you have one good game in the NBA and you have another game either 48 hours or the next day. So like you get to enjoy it for a night or the next night. You have one bad game and the next 2 weeks are ruined.
You carry it with you.
You know what I mean? You carry the losses with you so much more. So I think it's, again, I think the two hardest things in life are like to just be present and also stay balanced. Like those two things are so hard to do. And to that point of what I just spoke about, like, you know, I had to find balance and like, okay, there's going to be wins and losses. There's lessons in all of those. And also like stay present, like understand that like, you can either beat yourself up and it's, again, like I said earlier, gonna age the shit out of you, or you can say, hey, listen, I've been around this league long enough now. I'm gonna be okay. I'm gonna land on my feet. But again, we'll have another opportunity tomorrow. So I think it's all, again, in how you look at it and understanding yourself in that way.
Coming up, the game that changed everything for Kevin Love. His mental health crashes, and he finally gets some help.
Since the dawn of time, man has dreamed of bringing life back from the dead. From Orpheus and Eurydice to Frankenstein's monster, resurrection has long been merely the stuff of myth, fiction, and fairy tale. until now.
Actually, we still can't bring people back from the dead. That would be crazy, but the Dead Pilot Society podcast has found a way to resurrect great dead comedy pilots from Hollywood's finest writers. Every month, Dead Pilot Society brings you a reading of a comedy pilot that was sold and developed but never produced, performed by the funniest actors from film and television. How does Dead Pilot Society achieve this miracle? The answer can only be found at MaximumFun.org.
Back with NBA veteran Kevin Love of the Cleveland Cavaliers. In just a bit, we'll hear about the Kevin Love Fund and an education initiative he's helping to bring to schools. We talked about being in Minnesota in some dark times, and it became a much more public thing when you had a panic attack in a game against Atlanta. And I guess it became even more public when you opened up to the entire world about it. But tell us how that went down. You've played, you know, tons and tons of games by the time this game takes place. What happened in that game against the Hawks?
Yeah, I mean, I think it must have been almost, I don't know if it was like 700 games. Yeah, I'd already played professionally, as well as like 20 at that point, 2-3+ years of organized basketball.
Most of your life.
Yeah, most of my life. And I'd never had a public moment like that. And I think, you know, I always say it was like all the pillars in my life had kind of toppled over and gone to shit. And the last one was basketball. And we had all the expectation in the world. We had like traded a few guys on our team, Kyrie Irving being the primary superstar player that we traded, but also in return had, you know, guys like Derrick Rose. We had Dwayne Wade on our team. We added Isaiah Thomas, a few more players that we were still not only expected to make the finals, but maybe win the NBA championship. So, you know, we go into the season with very high expectations in 17-18. And again, my professional, personal, family life is not in a good place. Let's just leave it at that.
Yeah. So this is a situation where if you win, it's just what you're supposed to do. You don't get any credit. And if
Correct.
You lose, how could you lose when you've
right.
got... And LeBron was on that team too, right?
Yeah, he certainly was.
He's pretty good at basketball.
He's all right. Yeah. No, he's phenomenal. And that's why, again, the expectation was we were saying, why wouldn't they go to the NBA Finals and you know, beat the Warriors or compete with the Warriors? So I think we start out the season like, I don't know, you can look back like maybe like 3-7, and we're losing to the Hawks, who, yeah, 2 years prior to that were, you know, a top few seed in the Eastern Conference, but we're losing to them at halftime. Seems like things are going, you know, very, very wrong. You know, I'm stressed out. High anxiety. I think we're getting beat by maybe double digits going into halftime, and
untreated anxiety really at this point too, right?
No, for sure. Untreated, and something that I was just like, this is just life. This is just what I'm going to have to live with and deal with. So I better come to terms with it. But it got to a point, where right after halftime, we had called the first time out. They probably scored a couple straight baskets. Atlanta did. And that's when I just felt my heart rate just, you know, go from just over 100 to, you know, I felt like 200,
oh my God.
180 or 190, whatever my max is, you know, like I just, my heart started beating. I couldn't catch my breath. I feel like I'm having a cardiac type episode. I tell my coach starts talking to me. I remove myself from the huddle. He comes over like, what the hell is wrong? And then I just bail to the locker room. I'm like trying to find a place where I can either lay down. I don't know what the hell I'm looking for. I'm like, is this it?
I'm like, do I die?
I want to be seen? You know, am I pulling the shirt over my face like Caesar did so they can't see my last face? But I end up on the floor of our head athletic trainer's office and just have, full blown attack right there. And
I imagine you didn't know what a panic attack was at that point.
You know, I think because I'd always had somewhere to remove myself and always someplace to go, or like it manifested in like rage and like A lot of pillows were screamed into and broken and ripped apart. Mm. And in my youth, within my bedroom, that this was something more than that, because I didn't have any place to escape and go to when it got right to that breaking point. So I'm like, you know, fighting for air in my lungs. I feel like I'm trying to get something out of my throat. I can't, you know, I really feel like I'm having, like, my left side is breaking down. I'm having this like heart attack. And then I go to the Cleveland Clinic after, and which is a world-renowned hospital, especially great heart hospital as well, when it comes to taking care of that. And for me, that I just completely checked out. We ran every test in the world and it all came back clear. I'm a healthy athlete, and, you know, get your cholesterol down. No, but it just kind of hit me square in the face. Like, what the hell just happened? If everything checked out, what the hell just happened? So that was, again, I think there was a scary moment of it happening publicly and how it all went down. And then on the other side of that, it's like, well, what if this happens again? And also, did my teammates see, and the fear of, you know, is the organization going to trust me? Is this going to affect my happy place? Is this going to affect my, you know, being able to, you know, play basketball or take care of my family, and so on and so forth. So I think it was that never ending, you know, vicious cycle.
So you go to the Cleveland Clinic, you learn about panic attacks and how they feel like impending death. Do you get treatment at that point? Like, you're yet to go public about this stuff. Like, do you get to a therapist? Do you get to a doctor? What do you do?
Within 48 hours, and I want to say this, like, this isn't normal. Within 48 hours, I had seen my first therapist. I just looked in the mirror and I'm like, you know what? If you don't do this, then what's the point? Like, you know, so I think, yeah, it was within 48 hours. I remember we had like a 2-day break or a 3-day break, and then we played Milwaukee. And I was very fortunate. I was saying, this isn't something that always happens. It's like changing changing a college major. Like, your first person that you meet with and the first therapist that you meet with is actually the one that you end up staying with and really, you know, vibe with, and is somebody that you can lean on in moments. So I just went all in, and it has been the best, or one of very, very much at the top, the best thing that I've done for myself. And I did it for myself. It was something that, I don't know, just ended up working out in that way, if you will.
So, question I gotta ask, a lot of people listening to this don't make quite as much money at their jobs as you do. And a lot of people think, if I was getting nearly $29 million this year to play basketball or do anything, I would smile and feel great all day long. Right. How do you respond to that?
Well, I think I mentioned Bryan Cranston earlier. He had a great saying after Anthony Bourdain had taken his life. He said, it just shows you that, and for that matter, Kate Spade, within the same, I think, 2-week span, because she thought it would, you know, hurt her image if people knew about this, that success is not immune to depression. I use that all the time. And it normalized it for me as well, because, like, you know, if I could just, what, inject cash into my arm, like, it's all going to be better. Like, all right,
just buy some new mental health.
Yeah. Kevin. Forget the psychedelics or the SSRIs or, like, you know, these beautiful things that I can do to help my mental health. I'll just inject liquid cash into my arms and I'll be fine. No, but, you know, I'm not saying that, you know, that doesn't help. I mean, my relationship with money has always been pretty fucked up, from stemming way, way, way back. Again, to take it out, right?
But right. It'll solve everything.
Yeah, it'll solve everything. But you know, there's like these amazing, you know, 3x3 photos where you look at, like, you know, it's Richard Pryor, it's Robin Williams, mm-hmm. it's Anthony Bourdain, it's like all these people that, you know, Amy Winehouse, Kurt Cobain, like all these people that, you know, are in the public eye, who have world fame, who have legacy. Like, I mean, generational wealth in some cases with money. And yet, you know, these are people that have all died from either taking their lives or a product of, you know, opioid addiction or, you know, just it's, I think it's just in a lot of ways ignorant. I mean, like, I would just hope they would have an open mind and understand that this doesn't discriminate. And just because you have a currency, and honestly, not the only currency that matters, that it's not something that if you're just injected with it, that you're going to be okay. Like, it's just not the money. I mean, it's not going to solve everything. And sure, does it give you some freedom? Does it allow you access? Absolutely. But again, like I said, it's just not the only currency that matters. And those people that I mentioned, you know, are proof of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been interviewing people a long time, and I found that it was pretty easy to get comedians to talk about mental health. That's a big reason why I did what I did.
Oh, how funny. By the way, that is so spot on, by the way. I mean, it's like, I think it, a lot of that comes from the dark side of the personality.
Yeah. Yeah. But I found that it's a lot harder historically to get athletes to talk about it because really nothing to gain, especially if they're in a situation where they're trying to get another contract and they're trying to appear invulnerable. And, you know, like, they have everything to lose and nothing to gain from being open about mental health.
Right.
Why do you do it when you have, you know, when you're a professional athlete? Why open up about this stuff? Why be vulnerable about this? Why do you take your story public?
Well, two things, one being funny and one being pretty serious. The first being funny, I'll say that, like, I always say, like, listen, at the end of the day, yes, I do expose this stuff. Some of you might think it's soft. Some of you might think, like, I throw up these photos with my dog who acts as like a weighted blanket and that's soft or things. But, like, at the end of the day, if you want to get on the court and try me, like, let's fucking do this. Like, I'm still
soft.
The same person. Like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Like, and it's like,
crash the boards with Kevin Love and find
that's
out.
What I'm, that's
soft
what
he
I'm
is.
Saying. Like, listen, like, I'm still me at the end of the day. If anything, I'm a better version of myself. So on the other side of that, the serious answer is, like, for me, it was paying it forward. I found in my life, like, giving myself up for, you know, something bigger than myself actually makes me feel really good. I hate receiving gifts, but I'm a good gift giver. My wife would tell me I'm the worst gift receiver of all time. But I think it's, you know, just paying it forward for a kid who may have, or someone, it doesn't even have to be a kid. It can be anybody struggling that has, you know, felt the same way I've felt at times. And still, like, I live with it. I feel it right now. I have still have my medication, and it definitely, trust me, helps and has helped save my life, but still feel it every single day. But again, changed my relationship with it. But I decided to speak about it publicly for just that, like, one, and hopefully many that are, again, or have felt or feeling the same way that I've felt before, because it's not, first of all, not healthy, but it's just not, you know, what kind of life is that to be lived, especially when it's in the shadows and you don't feel like you can share it.
Right. Big, exciting times for the Kevin Love Fund and social emotional learning curriculum. Tell us,
yes,
tell us what you're, I know there's acronym opportunities. Tell us what you've been announcing.
Yeah. The SEL curriculum, if you will, we've been working on this for a couple of years. It's modeling vulnerability within the classroom. People ask me all the time, you know, what would you say to your younger self? And for me, it was, you know, speak your truth, especially around your peers, not have to go down the hallway to see a counselor, not have to go down the hallway to see a principal, vice principal, if you will, or even go outside the school, be able to share and be vulnerable with your peers in the classroom and, you know, be able to kind of learn on the fly with that. But it's not only, you know, lesson programs, which we have 14 of through several different mediums. It can be photography, it can be, you know, making playlists. It can be, like, I wrote a first person poem about my late grandmother that was super therapeutic for me. But it's also teaching them tools that they walk away from the classroom and understand how they can best benefit themselves, but also the people around them, the community around them, and create a better culture and more hope for, you know, the people that, you know, are in their everyday lives and have a ripple effect on everybody else. As you know, that happens when you, you know, take care of, number one, you take care of yourself.
I think for a lot of young people, the idea of being vulnerable in school is a fairly terrifying proposition, even though there are some wonderful rewards if you do that. How do you make it a safe environment for younger people so that they're confident in doing this so that they can get those rewards you're talking about?
Well, it all starts with the teacher. I mean, we have put in our teachers that have and our people that have helped make the curriculum have really done a great job of you know, helping our teachers get through the understanding of the curriculum and the process of, you know, making sure that they're well equipped to best service the students. So I think, you know, it's funny, we've seen a lot, I've seen it firsthand actually in Cleveland, physically in the classroom, how much of an impact those teachers actually have on their students. So I think it starts from a empathetic authority figure type of standpoint and has that ripple effect through all of the kids. You know, there was one very emotional moment at John Adams High School in Cleveland where a young lady who was sitting just a few seats down, I was the first one to, you know, share my poem and something that I had done, like I mentioned about my grandmother, but she had spoken about the teacher and how her willingness to give herself up as well as just be so instrumental in the lesson program and her sharing, the young lady sharing her story was so huge. So I think it all starts with, you know, definitely, you know, somebody else sharing the lesson plan. Like we've had Chris Ball, we've had Brian Cranston, we've had others, you know, whether they're like a person that's not only a celebrity or somebody within the public eye, but other peers or different groups of people that, you know, fosters, you know, a sense of not only awareness, but empathy and a safe space more than anything within the classroom. So it is a daunting task. We thought, you know, to ourselves, kind of how are we going to make this work? But we've seen incredible results. And it's, as of now, been in 250 schools and over 10,000 students. And it's going to be nationwide for free come October. It's beautiful.
That's Kevin Love. I'm rooting for him. I'm rooting for the Cleveland Cavaliers in general this year because they have a lot of guys on their team who are regarded around the league as interesting and extra nice and often kind of funny and weird. Robin Lopez signed with Cleveland, and he's known for staging mock wrestling matches against other teams' mascots and being good at basketball, but the mascot thing is pretty awesome. We have a video of it on our show page. It has nothing to do with mental health and very little to do with basketball, but you get to see a guy who looks like a tall, buff Sideshow Bob beat up a Velociraptor mascot, which is kind of awesome. Next time on Depression Mode, Hrishi wanted to write more songs, but there were these voices in his head telling him that he sucked really bad. And the thing about those voices is that they were very talented.
They're very smart and have such great reasoning. It's hard to really go against them. Hear all the reasons that they lay out for why I am a no-talent hack, and I'm like, I'm convinced.
Hrishikesh Hirway, creator and host of Song Exploder, joins us. And everybody take a breath and then let the breath out. And as the breath comes out, Laura House comes in. Hi, Laura.
Hello.
Laura joins us for a meditation moment.
That's like my Lenny and Squiggy entrance.
Hello.
And the breath comes in. Hello.
Oh, man. Those guys were awesome.
The best.
Yeah. Well, guide us, won't you, in a meditation moment?
Yes, of course. This is available anytime. You could just check out a little with some meditation. Free of charge.
No,
it's right there.
No online registration needed.
No commute. It's right there in you at any moment. So the hard part is this, making yourself do it. So you just get comfortable in a seat. You want to be able to close your eyes safely, no driving. Start with your head upright and just close your eyes. Just close your eyes and be comfortable for a moment. And then notice your breath. Might be the first time today or in a while, but just notice it. It's happening. There's no forcing or controlling. And you will have thoughts, and your mind will naturally go from noticing your breath into getting really interested in your thoughts. totally okay. But when you're aware of it, you just notice your breath again, sort of glancing in the direction of your breath. Just let go. Go ahead and open your eyes. I think of it sometimes as throwing up little detour signs. Mm-hmm. Like if my mind is like, oh, but I have things to worry about and there's stuff I have to do later. It's like, no, breath. Like it's not a to-do list. It's like, right. Okay.
It's just a pause button and you'll, mm-hmm. You can get to that stuff later. You can spare a moment or two to do something like this. You can find Laura House at laurahouse.com. You can also find her on the Tiny Victories podcast here on Maximum Fun that she hosts with Annabelle Gurwitch. Laura, thank you.
Thank you.
If people support our show, we get to have a show. If they don't, we don't. Let's have a show, shall we? If you already donate to Depression Mode, thank you. You make this show possible. If you haven't yet, it's so easy. Just go to MaximumFun.org/join, select Depression Mode, find a level that works for you. There's all kinds of levels, and help us out. Be sure to hit subscribe and give us 5 stars and write good reviews. That makes our show show up more on the various podcast platforms, and that's a good thing. The Suicide and Crisis Lifeline is available in the United States by calling 988 or 1-800-273-TALK. The Crisis Text Line, also free, always available. Text HOME to 741-741. The Hilarious World of Depression, the book, is now available as of tomorrow, actually, the day after this podcast drops. Maybe you don't listen on the same day the podcast drops. Maybe you listen a day later. At which point, the book will already be out there in the world. I hope you read it. It's a memoir that I wrote about mental health, and various celebrities join in to talk about their experiences, and there are a lot of jokes, and it seems to have helped a lot of people. Now available in paperback, where books are sold, because it's a book. Our electric mail address is depressionmode@maximumfun.org. If you're on Facebook, look up our mental health discussion group, Preshies. Lots of good conversation going on there. Not just about the show, but about mental health, people helping other people. It's kind of the platonic ideal of what Facebook ought to be. Our Depression Mode newsletter is available on Substack. Search that up. I'm on Twitter @JohnMoe. High credits, listeners. The Cleveland Cavaliers haven't always been my favorite team, but I've always loved their name. Cavalier can mean showing a lack of proper concern. So like if a player doesn't go after a rebound or fails to defend, thus taking a cavalier attitude, well, what can you expect, given the name? Cavalier can also mean a supporter of King Charles I in the English Civil War of 1642, which I'm sure applies to Kevin Love. Depression Mode is produced by Gabe Mara. Our senior producer is Kevin Ferguson, and we get booking help from Mara Davis. Rhett Miller wrote and performed our theme song, Building Wings.
I'm always falling off of cliffs now, building wings on the way down. I am figuring things out, building wings, building wings, building wings. No one knows the reason, maybe there's no reason, I just keep believing. No one knows the answer, maybe there's no answer, I just keep on dancing.
Hey, this is Jesus from Long Beach. Hang in there. You're stronger than you think.
Depression Mode is a production of Maximum Fun and Papa Chick. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.